Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer and The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Pushkin. I first discovered Leonard Cohen, like most people, through his song Hallelujah, a beautiful and complex song with a ton of verses. But I grew to love him after discovering his early albums full of nylon string guitars and songs much more succinct than Hallelujah. Though Leonard never got quite the amount of attention that his peers did, like Bob Dylan and Paul Simon, he was every bit the poet they are. Cohen died in 2016, less than a month after the release of his last album. It was a project recorded in his modest duplex in the Mid-Wilshire neighborhood of Los Angeles. Leonard made the album with his son Adam Cohen. It wasn't meant to be his last work, but it felt like a fitting end, until this turned up. While mourning his father's death, Adam took some of the poetry Leonard had recorded and set it to music. And now, very unexpectedly, we have a brand new album from Leonard Cohen called Thanks for the Dance. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond.
Just a quick note here. You can listen to all of the music mentioned in this episode on our playlist, which you can find a link to in the show notes. For licensing reasons, each time a song is referenced in this episode, you'll hear this sound effect. All right, enjoy the episode.
Rick Rubin knew Leonard Cohen for about a decade before his passing. Afterwards, Leonard's son Adam reached out to Rick, wanting to tell him a story about his father, the one you're about to hear.
When's the last time we saw each other?
I was trying to remember. It feels like so long ago, all of it. I was trying to remember. I mean, I know the feeling that I was left with in that story that my dad always used to tell about you, and you became the brunt of almost like a punchline. But now the whole thing's dissipated into a general tapestry and feeling of, you know, I guess a mix, a cocktail, a blend of maybe inaccuracies and feelings mixed together. But I want to try to summon, if it's appropriate,
yes,
the story about you.
Yeah, tell me the story as you remember it.
It has something to do with his general feeling about himself not being a stallion in the race of show business. And by that, I mean, he would refer to other guys he came up with, whether it's Kristofferson or Baez or Joni or Dylan or all the cats that were coming up in his era, as knowing what to do, he would say. these guys know what to do. All I've ever known is out of black and a page, you would say. That's where you have to understand that context before Rick Rubin enters into the conversation. So then the question is, two guys sitting at a table and some music industry related question emerges. And he says, I don't know, Adam. I mean, you know, like we should ask Rick, you know, like Rick Rubin would know this. And so very quickly that morphs into any question that we have, ask Rick. Yeah, ask Rick. You know, I come to him with a genuine question. Dad, you know, what should I do about this? If it's music related, and then it turns into a punchline. He said, you know, Adam, you know what I'm about to say. Ask Rick Rubin. And of course, you know, I hadn't met you.
No, it's you so know? Funny. I didn't know any of this until you told me this after your dad passed.
Yeah. And so I felt like I had to track you down on the off chance he was right, you know. I have to ask Rick. And I have subsequently asked you on many occasions, and you've proven right every time.
Wow.
So thank you.
Pretty good. My pleasure. It's an amazing story. It makes me laugh every time.
Yeah, me too.
Tell me about your dad's newest project.
I know. Isn't that incredible?
It's so cool.
I suppose that the most gratifying part, other than the fact that it wasn't a humiliating disaster, and the fact that it's resonant and that I think it's beautiful and people are responding to it so favorably, I think the headline is that person after person who hears it, one of the most gratifying things that is said of it time and time again is that they feel like, oh my God, Leonard Cohen is still here. He's speaking to us still. And with this message in tow, with this beautiful offering, this command of language, this inimitable gift that he's always had, still having it. I mean, of course, I could go into detail because I have...
Yeah, tell me about the specifics of the making of it. Like, how did the idea come? Start from the beginning.
Well, the first thing that happened was my old man passed away, and I live about 750 meters down the same street where you visited. And I'm left with this notion that one of the ways in which I can visit with him so palpably, as opposed to so many other people who lose a parent or someone, I've got all these recordings, and they are the sum of his being in many instances. They are the sum of what he practiced to be in this world. And they are literally his words, his voice in recordings. And at one point, I, out of desperation and a tiny pinch of courage, I dared open up the sessions in my backyard. And I just wanted to sit with him. I missed him. And it was a way of conversing, of remaining in dialogue with the guy. That was the beginning. And then something really unexpected and magical happened. A record is not a fait accompli. Even good songs do not result in good recordings, even in your hands. It doesn't matter if the artist and the song and the producer and the musicians, it is not a guarantee of anything. And so the fact that a record actually emerged that's finished and that's resonant and that's emotional and that's truthful, it's not in my hands. I don't have the qualifications to do that. It emerged.
And it's out of our control.
It's out of our control. Yeah. And so I have two strikes against me for this record in terms of my actual true participation, you know. One is that I neither have great and esteemed credentials, and two, this wasn't my record. You know, I wasn't trying to make my choices.
Of course.
I was trying to, at all times, because of this conversation that I was in, say, like, Dad, do you like this? Is this what you would do? Is this truthful? And so it eliminated this tragic layer that we often impose on ourselves of doubt.
Yes.
It was, I don't have to consult myself. All I have to do is consult him. Yeah. He was very clear about what he did and didn't like.
Yes.
And that's the great advantage that I had over people who were like you, for example.
Yes.
I knew what he hated.
Of course.
You know?
You know what's interesting? I never thought about this before, but for any other artist, this would be a more difficult process. But because Leonard's music always essentially started with the poetry, and that was the basis of the greatness of the songs, the heavy lifting was already done. So this is the best example of being able to make something really truthful to him, where the participation that he already did really is the key.
Yeah. I was thinking that on the drive up here. You know, there's a song called The Goal, which is, it's literally no more than a minute long. And his reading, which had no music, it was just a reading. His reading sounds like a thespian from the other side of the world. The command of language, the cinematic transportive quality, and then to end, you know, by saying, no one to follow, nothing to teach, except that the goal falls short of the reach.
So beautiful. Amazing. Amazing.
I wholeheartedly agree. It's so wonderful that that exists.
Yeah.
And it's so true. And what a truthful position that he had. I can see him sitting in his little fedora and in his suit, staring at his window, returning a neighbor's smile with that sense of defeat.
Yes.
But at the same time, the word defeat to people has this binary quality to most people. It's measured against winning, for example. Yes. But to him, it was part of this thesis that he had that his whole life was about, which is brokenness, broken hallelujah, the crack in everything. Mm-hmm. The whole notion that defeat and imperfection and brokenness was the fabric of the experience. And then instead of just, you know, having the plaintive assertion, the real generosity was to write about it in a way that you hadn't considered, with generosity, with voluptuousness, with inventiveness. And then, you know, if you could, on top of it, set it to a melody, you know, like what nicotine is in a cigarette, like it's a nicotine delivery system. He was giving you like a transcendent delivery system. That's what he was trying to do every time. You would hate that I said that. But that's what I think he was trying to do.
What was it like growing up with him? How much time do you spend with him through childhood?
Yeah, I don't know that that's a question that I can answer in a complete manner, you know? I mean, the immediate answer is, I don't know, because I've only had that, so I have nothing else to measure it against. And it was incredible. Now that he's gone and that I consult him more as a man than a parent, and I see him as a lifetime of choices, fantastic, altruistic, amazing, bizarre, eccentric, devoted, religious, seeker-like choices. I find him ever more remarkable, and the fact that he was able to, you know, remain in his children's lives despite it not really being an appetite of his at the beginning. But for me, there was this torture of what he called the family business. Now, he could call it the family business, and he would say, oh, the Cohen boys and the family business. And, you know, but if I dared say the family business, you know, he would say, like, what do you mean family business? You know, you're,
so
you know,
funny.
It was this endless geyser of support and understanding. I mean, he would lean over my notebook and give me suggestions. He would say, this is what you got to do. You know, although you got to ask Rick, because I don't know. And at the same time, you know, I remember when Instagram came around and my handle is Commander Cohen, and he found out about it. He said, "You're stealing my identity." I said, "Dad, what are you talking about?" You know, like, you
did
were
he
so,
say it laughingly?
That's the thing. No.
Yeah.
You know, he was like, for example, there was an article in which, you know, I had said like kind of something like, "Look, there's no one like Leonard Cohen. But I'm like certainly on the mainland, but I'm the closest thing to it. If, you know, we're talking about way offshore, distant little, you know, distant little islets." And he says, "What are you talking about? You're the closest thing to Leonard Cohen." You know, this is the kind of, I don't know whether he was as irritated as the tone indicated, but again, it was also accompanied by this, you know, "Dad, I quit. I don't want to be your producer. This is ridiculous." He said, "Dad," he says, "Adam, where are you going? I can't do this without you."
Yeah.
You know? So there was this wonderful and constant contradiction, you know? Like, I referred to his music one time in a magazine as mytho-romantic. And I thought, oh my God, this is so perfect. It really is mytho-romantic. I mean, you know, the idea that woman is God and God is woman, and you know, the cathedral that his words are echoing in, and that he built stone by stone, word by word. And he says, "Remind me to reduce your oeuvre to a couple words, kid." You know, and I'm like, "Dad, what are you talking about? You know, mytho-romantic, it's good." And then, you know, two Sabbath dinners later, he's like, "My son, who coined the term mytho-romantic," putting his arm around me. This is crazy.
He's so funny.
And exactly. And of course, none of it was malicious. And I never felt like it was in an episode of Succession where I was going to, you know, like he was going to try to kill me. But given the modesty, it goes back to your original question, which was like, what was it like living with him? He was so modest. Mm. He was so down to earth. I mean, this is a guy who lived in an apartment, you know, and drove a 1984 Nissan Pathfinder whose battery need to be jumped every morning, you know? I mean, yes, he did go through a $5,000 can of caviar, you know, in the same afternoon. And he did have a propensity for Hebrew National kosher salami, but he was this elegant old world man who, I think the reason I stumbled in answering you earlier was because it provoked such a feeling, and the feeling is this: he had so many distinguishing characteristics that I wished I could find in myself, that it was never oppressive, but it was unachievable for most anybody.
For sure.
And, but he liked you though. And often said things of that nature about you to me.
Incredible.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? I mean, we're talking about a kind of larger than lifeness.
Yes.
And at the same time, he was this little Jew who wrote the Bible, you know?
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about his spirituality?
Not in a way he would approve of.
But as you saw it, your perspective.
I think he was a seeker. I think he just had an appetite. You know, if I was to, you know, 2-cent psychoanalyze him, I'd say a guy who loses his father at the age of 9 years old is always looking for something. And in this case, it was the archetypal man, the source of strength and wisdom. And although he found pillars of that strength and wisdom within certain segments of Judaism, he also found it in Christianity, in Catherine Tekakwitha, and in several masters that he followed along the way, and in wine, and in women, and in song. And he met my mother while he was in Scientology for a brief moment with L. Ron Hubbard. I mean, anything goes if it's got a little bit of a buzz. Speed, absinthe, medical marijuana, whatever.
Yeah, I remember him always offering absinthe whenever I would see him.
Yeah. He liked to get high.
Yeah.
He loved it. And didn't have to be with a substance. He just loved to let go of that fastening, that oppressive fastening that we do almost involuntarily to the center of ourselves, which is not even a very pleasant place to be. Mm.
I remember asking him if he read any of the newer poets, and he said that he only reads spiritual texts now. He doesn't look at anything. He's not interested in anything beyond spiritual texts. That was interesting.
Mm. Yeah, I didn't follow too closely what he was reading, other than what he would tell me. And there was again, these are all admissions that I'm having trouble making, because, you know, I sort of feel like he would say, Jesus, Adam, you're incorrigible. I mean, don't demystify me. I've spent my whole life putting veils up. But I think he had forfeited reading for the irresistible ease of online publications, of lectures online. And I know that he was following some pretty wacky folks, from rabbis and Sikhs to Hindu gurus. And, you know, he was deep, deep into listening to people speaking.
Yeah, he invited me to see Rabbi Findlay with him several times. Mm-hmm. And absolutely. I still have not yet done it, yeah. But I still plan
to. Let's go one of these days. He's a beautiful, robust, interesting, charismatic character, ex-Marine from Irish descent, who became incredibly versed in all things Jewish, but with a really modern and moderate bent. Mm. Very cool guy.
After the break, we'll debut a song from Leonard Cohen's new album, Thanks for the Dance.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
We're back with Adam Cohen.
Should we talk a little bit about the album before this one? The last one he was present for?
Well, that was beautiful for me. And not just because the record turned out beautifully, and although my father passed away only 3 weeks after it came out, he did get to, you know, when he played it for you, yeah, he came over to the house, or yeah, when he played it for people whose opinion he was seeking, or with whom he just wanted to share the music, yeah, and then eventually the world, that a collect, you know, this is where it's, he was such an unsentimental guy that I almost feel like I'm trespassing. But for me, it was sentimental to be summoned to work with my father, in whose footsteps I tried with clumsiness to follow. To go from basically glorified coffee boy, you know, in the basement of the building, to ending up in the penthouse making boardroom decisions with a boss, except the boss was in a medical chair, you know, in his living room in mid-Wilshire. Yeah. to actually having this resonant music, to wrestling with the master and not getting creamed. And in fact, you know, when another thing that when you came up in conversation, you know, and pardon me for the oversimplifying, but when he would say, you know, Rick or Don Was or Dan Lana, they want me to go back. They want me to literally regress to making, you know, an old Leonard Cohen album with just nylon string guitars and stuff. Like, I don't want to do that. You know, like, I'm not a museum piece. I'm not even particularly nostalgic. But of course, I believe that you were right, and that desire for Leonard Cohen to tickle that and evoke that sense that we have in our mind's eye of what Leonard Cohen is, not just spiritually, not just lyrically, but also sonically in terms of the architecture that accompanies him, was such a strong desire. And when he finally was weak enough to relent and allow that just for a second, especially with this, his son, to have that nylon string guitar come back, to quiet the background vocals and excavate enough space for him in the verses so that the narratorship was unchallenged. And they could go back to that other union that he had created, which is that yin and yang, where he has this masculine baritone narratorship, and then there's this incredible generous complicitness from the female backgrounds. So there's this union. And this is an architecture that he helped excavate. Mm-hmm. So to restore that, but at the end of his life, with that gravity, with that somberness, with that sharpness, with that courage to go into the darkness and come back with a little parcel of truth that he had, was incredibly edifying, you know, and touching for me. And
you mentioned his medical chair. When I came to visit him, he literally looked like a king in a throne. It was unbelievable. He was so elegantly dressed, as always.
Yes.
But so beautiful, and sitting in this grand chair in this small space.
Yeah.
It really took my breath away. Every time I visited him, it was always thrilling for me, but maybe even more so then, and none of us, I mean, I certainly didn't know that he was going anytime soon, because we were already talking about what he was going to do next. It's like he already told me he was excited. He was writing for the next album, which is now happening.
No, he was living, you know. I often said to my friend here, Michael, who again mixed and recorded, both that record and this one, you know, I said, like, you know, he's staying alive for this. This is the only thing he's living for.
Yeah.
And often, unfortunately, that statement was made, or that declaration was uttered when we were going nowhere. And it just felt like he was stalling. And it was like, Dad, we get it. When you finish this record, you're gonna let go, but only when you finish the work. He was a pit bull at the sleeve of this mission,
yeah.
Whether it was blackening pages or finishing a lyric and then refinishing it.
Yes.
Yeah, but it was this indelible and very clear sense that he was living for the work. That's yes. all he was living
and
for.
And that was why when he played me the new finished work, the first thing I said was, so what's the next song going to be like? What's the, you know, have you started on the next album yet? Knowing that he needed that.
Yeah.
And knowing that we want to hear that. It's like good for everybody.
Did he do that thing that he sometimes we do, almost like a magician with a card trick? Did he dispense on you lyrics that he was working on?
Yeah.
Wasn't that just magical?
Yeah, amazing.
One of the things I miss the most is, you know, dropping by and having him without a teleprompter. I mean, yes. We're talking about a man who is literally swimming in toms and toms and toms of not just words, but like heavy, dense and delicious language.
Yes.
And for him to pull him out, you know, and it doesn't matter whether it's pulling out Blake or Shakespeare or his own work. The lucidity and the sharpness right to the end. But then to hear the deliciousness of a concoction that he was, you know, in the throes of, you know, isn't that just a delicious memory?
Unbelievably thrilling. And I'm sure over the years, there were many that you got to hear that maybe never came to pass.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because on this record, I had to beg him. I said, Dad, you know that song, Puppets? Just speak it. I know you are not co-signing. You don't believe that there's music that exists for this.
Yes.
Or Night of Santiago. Or there's several others where I said, just read it. Read it to a metronome.
Yes.
We'll figure that out later. But don't not speak this into a microphone.
Yes.
And that's how delicious some of those moments were. You know, yeah, there's some, unfortunately, I didn't get. In fact, the last song on this album is called Listen to the Hummingbird. And we were done with the record. And Michael and I were in Berlin at a festival called People Festival, which is organized by Justin Vernon, Bon Iver,
mm-hmm.
and the Desners from the National. And Bon Iver's music was, we were sharing a studio and we had a shared wall, and all of these incredible moving evocative sonics were coming through the wall. And instead of hating him and resenting him for interrupting what would otherwise have been our session, we were inspired and we said to ourselves, oh my goodness, the very last time this man spoke in public, he impromptu did what we're talking about. He said, hey, do you want to hear something I'm working on? And he read into a 58 in a halogen lit conference room, a press event. He read out loud this poem, and we remembered it. Contacted Sony, said, is there any way you could locate that one moment in that press conference, turn it into a WAV file, send it to us, and with this stuff coming through the shared wall, we composed this track.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's such a pleasure hearing him speak.
It was delicious.
Yeah.
I miss it. I really miss it, you know.
On the last album, was that recorded with his band?
Nothing was recorded with his band. No, what the sort of sonic defining characteristic of the last record, not this new one, was a men's choir that's also on this album. In fact, on this album, there's a song called Puppets where it boldly starts with German puppets burnt the Jews. Jewish puppets did not choose. I mean, this is an arresting and bold beginning to any lyric that arguably should maybe not even be in a song. But that men's choir, the Jewish men's choir, and this Berlin-based German choir are both on the song, and they're both singing.
Let's listen to that.
It's a pretty wacky one.
Okay. He seems to be saying we're all puppets.
Yes, sir. Yeah. He was studying with this guy called Balsakar in India, where he would go after Roshi, his Zen teacher, passed away. And the thesis of Balsakar, which he was really taken by at the end and became his sort of central spiritual backbone, was there is no doer. There is no doer whatsoever. It's a kind of fatalistic, but without the oppressiveness of the word fatalist. This idea that it's all written by some program. So puppets for sure, but even smaller than puppets. You know, he would often say, you can read every word on the page, you just can't change any of them in the script of your life.
And also speaks to the resignment in the lyric that you quoted earlier of waving to the neighbor. And
yeah, the resignation of I sit in my chair, I look at the street, the neighbor returns my smile of defeat. I move with the leaves, I shine with the chrome. I'm almost alive, I'm almost at home.
Yeah, and also it relates to the what we were talking about in the making of art process, the fact that it's out of our control. It's all one thing. Do you know what I'm saying?
Again, I go back to being infuriated by his contradictions. I just have another story. Again, you know, I finished a record at one point and I met him at Starbucks on Wilshire and La Brea. And I had this big declaration to him for which I was, I think, seeking validation and maybe even a compliment. I said, Dad, once we were sat with coffees in the sun, I said, Dad, I'm scrapping the entire record. I'm going to start over. And I thought he would put his hand on my shoulder and say, like, my son, you know, like the Kipling poem, you know. He says, what an amateur move, he says to me. I said, Dad, I said, what are you talking about? He says, it's show business, man. It's not how you feel about the work. It's about how you make us feel about the work. It has nothing to do with altruistic, you know, like that the writing is that.
Yes.
The, you know, like be truthful while you're writing, seek, you know, to be stirred by the muses. But once you're recording, I mean, that is an act of pandering. You have to go the whole hog. He says, you think I mean it every night when I'm on my knees singing Hallelujah? You think Mick means it every night when he's singing, you know, I Can't Get No? He says, you know, like the true generosity is to not care whether you do or don't mean it, you know? And then I'm thinking like, wait a minute, Dad, hold on. I've been in the studio with you now.
Yes.
And I see how many times you...
Yes.
Have trashed and begun again and not accepted and stalled. And so wait a minute, you know, again, these infuriating, diametrically opposed and battling notions. Remember that, Michael?
Publisher perish.
Publisher perish, he said. He just kept on repeating that. Get off the pot. I'd say, well, what about you, Dad? You know, like 12 years to finish a song. You know, he'd say, oh, yeah, well, I was getting it right.
I think he was telling you what he wanted to tell himself.
I also think that there is a I'm not much of a sports fan, but there's a thing that boxers say to each other. They say there's levels to this, you know, just because Ali can do it doesn't mean you can.
Yeah.
Just because Floyd Mayweather can do it doesn't mean you can. And I don't mean to suggest that he was as callous and conceited as to imply that as clearly as I'm indicating, but I think he was saying, look, when you're writing Psalms of King David, like I am,
yes,
you know, you can afford to take your time.
I don't think he's saying that.
Okay, good.
I don't think he's saying that. Thank you for assuaging
my concern.
No. I think he's saying, he's telling you what he needs to hear. That's what I think was happening. He was giving you his best advice that he was not able to take for himself.
I don't know, Rick. That doesn't resonate as true. And I'm not,
I think you might be too close.
Yeah, I might be too close. I don't feel like myself bucking, you know, or tangling antlers with you, because that's I don't have the stature to win at that.
There's no winning. By the way, there's no competition.
Yeah. No,
we're not winning. We're sharing ideas.
But I do believe that that's not true, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
I don't believe in the idea of all things equal. And in fact, I believe that, you know, what the definition of the word miracle is: a breach in the law of nature.
Yes.
He was a breach in the law of nature.
Yes.
He can allow himself exception. That's what he was. And to go to another sort of analogous, or the sisterhood of that idea, would be the word scarcity. You know, the idea that something is something's value is directly measured by how little of it there is. And he was not a prolific man. And unlike Dylan, who was, you know, who just spat them out, you know, he was chiseling at marble. And he would always refer to himself as slow, but it was never disparagingly.
Yes.
There was a methodical, conscious, there was a notion from a young man, if you go back to his journals, and which I have unfortunately, you know, or fortunately had to do. I'm so buried in all things Leonard Cohen these days. But there was this sense that he had this mandate from G-D to go into the darkness. And we don't all have that. That would be presumptuous and arrogant.
Do you think he included himself in the puppets in the song that we just
absolutely
talked about?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You're right. but again, there's Puppet Mountains,
yes,
and there's Puppet Molehills.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, but we agree.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes. I'm not thinking that he thought less of himself in any way, and I'm not thinking that, and I will tell you, I don't think he looked down on your work versus his work. I don't believe that.
Well, that would be crazy, Rick.
I don't believe that. I just don't believe that.
I promise that on the drive home, I'll think more about this.
Yeah. Because I think he clearly knew he was great, but he also saw all of the downsides. I don't think that he saw anything as perfect.
No,
you're right. That's what I'm thinking. I don't think he thought about things by rank. I don't think, but I don't know.
Yeah, no. I never got that from him. Yeah, well, he wasn't in the position of he was one of the least judgmental characters I've ever met. So for that, I agree. But understanding things, place, and resonance, and understanding that some things were whispers and some things were seismic tremors. For example, he would say, I'm not one of the big guys, but I do understand that I have, you know, I think he would say, my little toe in the door jamb of the annals of history.
Yes.
And so this was a sense of modesty, but a sense of place.
Yes. I think it's realistic. Yeah. You know, he was realistic.
Yeah. But boy, the exception that he was, that as his contemporaries aged out, or are aging out, that their offerings, their little wild bouquets that they're still holding, have less and less pertinence and have more and more of that sense of like being a nostalgia act, and that he, as opposed to them, remained so vital. And it was, I think it was because he was really clawing his way up, you know, with his deteriorating little frail body, even, you know, clawing his way and really speaking from the rank at which he found himself.
Yes.
You know, he was really, he wasn't trying to say baby, baby, baby.
Yes.
He was trying to say, we kill the flame if that's what you want, my Lord. Yes. You know, he was really, he wasn't revisiting anything. That's why he took offense to some notions that he'd go backwards.
Yeah.
You know, he was trying to remain vital.
Yeah. I don't think I ever got to explain it well to him, but my version of him going backwards.
Tell me so I can tell him later.
Okay. Had more to do with his songwriting changed in a way that became more punchline based over time. And his earlier songs didn't have that. And I missed the songs without the punchlines. And that would have been my one request, if to think about writing songs that didn't rely on the punchline. Because I think once he fell into that, I think it made it easier to write the songs for him. It was an organizing principle that made the having that structure was easier to work towards.
Yeah, he would refer to it as he would often talk about Arthur Miller and how the plays got shorter and shorter, but the impact didn't.
Yeah,
and you know how his life energy was different, and anything that allowed for the juice to keep flowing,
yes,
was more vital than anything. So, you know, however you got there, you just got to keep on getting there. So I do also see the economy. But, you know, the funny thing is, what era are you speaking about? Of course, his earlier work had this kind of languid, you know, such deep voluptuousness. And then, you know, by the time even he was doing Hallelujah,
mm-hmm,
that was a lot more terse, a lot more economic. And then by the time he was doing There's a Crack in Everything, That's How the Light Gets In, he had found that voice that he, yes, remained with to the end.
Yes.
In other words, it wasn't a forfeiture of poetry,
yes,
but it was an economy.
Yes.
I love your term punchline,
yes,
because he did look for them.
I know.
But never succumbing to what he would call sloganeering.
Yes.
He would always want to, he would try to rise above slogans.
Yes.
You know, and he would always say to me, you know, like, I take the inner life really seriously.
Yes.
And I think that's why it resonates so much to us, because you know this man is not sloganeering.
Yes.
He is tapping into something. He's mining.
For sure.
Where you dare not go.
For sure. How many albums did he make?
I don't know. Gosh, I don't know. In total, 12, 13, 14.
And that's interesting, too, because if we were to compare him to any of his contemporaries,
there were fewer.
Much fewer.
Oh, yeah.
Much, much, much fewer.
Yeah.
You know, probably one-fifth of,
yes,
anyone else.
Yes. Yeah. That reminds me of I think it's the E.E. Cummings quote. It says, every artist has an embarrassingly slim cartridge of good work.
Hmm.
I think he was very aware of that and kind of eschewed some of the pitfalls of what my friend reminded me here, publish or perish. You know, he almost did perish a few times waiting to publish.
Yes.
But the good thing is that he emerged with these diamonds, with, yes, these gems.
Coming up after the break, one more gem from Leonard Cohen and his son Adam. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card.
Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
We're back with more of Rick Rubin's conversation with Adam Cohen.
Okay, Happens to the Heart is the alma mater. It's the thing he was obsessively working on. If you came over, there would be notepads and scraps of paper everywhere, and it was the thing he was the most consumed with. We didn't get it. He didn't get it on You Want It Darker, and he kept on working on it. It was one of the first songs, one of the first two songs that we pulled up when we were in my backyard. And it does sort of surmise the perch from which he was looking at life. The strange modesty and yet captainhood of his own life that he was claiming. I guess we could play that one.
Let's do. Incredible. Beautiful. I'm so glad you made it.
So glad we did it. I can't believe he's still speaking to us.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
Leonard Cohen's new album, Thanks for the Dance, is out everywhere on November 22nd. You can check out a list of some of our favorite Leonard Cohen songs by visiting brokenrecordpodcast.com and subscribing to our playlist for this episode. And when the album's out, we'll put it up there for you too. You can also sign up for a behind-the-scenes newsletter while you're there. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell and Mia Lobel. Our theme music is by the great Kenny Beats. Stay tuned for next week's episode with Nora Jones. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? a room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.